These are the thoughts of all men in all ages and lands. They are not original with me. If they are not yours as much as mine, they are nothing.
1855, the city of Brooklyn. Walt Whitman self-published Leaves of Grass. Its subject was simply America, or as he said, Americans of all nations at any time upon the earth. No one had ever written or read poetry like this, and even today, 150 years later, Whitman still astonishes.
Leaves of Grass sometimes seems as if it was written with bolts of lightning going off in the background.
Whitman was a rebel. Whitman was a radical.
Unscrew the locks from the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams.
I mean, it's outrageous. And it's meant to be outrageous.
This hour, I tell things in confidence. I might not tell everybody, but I will tell you.
I'm Carl Hancock Rux. Stay tuned for Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, a special program from WNYC, New York Public Radio. In 1855, Walt Whitman, a 36-year-old freelance journalist and part-time house builder living in the city of Brooklyn, self-published a collection of 12 poems called Leaves of Grass. It was radically different than anything else in print at the time. One reviewer wrote, We have glanced through this book
with disgust and astonishment that anyone can be found who would dare print such a farrago of rubbish. It is generally indecent, execrably profane.
The New York Times called Leaves of Grass a thin and pretentious book, scolding him for styling himself
as the representative of America, the mouthpiece of free institutions, the personification of all that men had hoped for.
But that same critic concedes,
it would be unjust to deny the remarkable powers which are presented in this work.
150 years later, Whitman is regarded by many as the great American poet. The man once accused of repulsive indecency has become the sanitized good gray poet who wrote patriotic verse that people still remember from their school days. But like his early critics, we're still trying to understand who Walt Whitman was, what he was saying, and what he was styling himself to be.
Closer yet I approach you. What thought you have of me now, I had as much of you. I laid in my stores in advance. I considered long and seriously of you before you were born. Who was to know what should come home to me? Who knows but I am enjoying this? Who knows for all the distance but I am as good as looking at you now, for all you cannot see me?
What is it, then, between us? Walt Whitman asks in his great poem, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. Well, what is it, Mr. Whitman? Was Leaves of Grass just a book of poems? Or was it a manifesto on multiculturalism before that notion even existed? Was it a paean to love and sex and freedom? Was it just some guy's utopian dreams of an ideal America or a blueprint for a real America? A century and a half later, are we ready for the America of Walt Whitman's dreams? Let's begin looking for Walt Whitman on the streets of New York City. Walt Whitman arrived in Brooklyn when he was 4 years old, and he made it his home for the next 40 years. He once said that Leaves of Grass was a record of the years he spent in New York City. According to Greg Trupiano, a Whitman enthusiast who stages readings of his poetry, Whitman came to know the city the same way we do today.
Whitman was a great walker. All his poetry I look at as one great walk.
The blab of the pave, the tires of carts and slough of boot soles and talk of the promenaders, the heavy omnibus, the driver with his interrogating thumb, the clank of the shod horses on the granite...
Obviously, New York is a walking city, but in Whitman's lifetime, everything was cheek by jowl on the street.
Kenneth Jackson.
It's crowded. It's smelly. There's, excuse my French, horse shit all over the place. But more than that, you're going to cut between one horse's tail and wagons. To cross Broadway, for example, it would have taken some guts.
Whitman was not a particularly early riser. He would get to the Brooklyn Daily Eagle office, do some work, and then in the afternoon he would walk down to the East River where Mr. Gray had his bathing establishment, and then he would hop on a ferry for some good times in Manhattan.
He was very tall, broad-shouldered.
Joanne Krieg.
Some people said he had a kind of a rolling gait when he walked.
He probably would have walked all the way up to what we might think of as Soho now, that's south of Houston Street, all the areas of Lower Broadway.
Whitman loved the dandies that he saw dressed on Broadway, and every one, especially men, was a potential lover.
Peter Coviello.
There is an ineradicable cruisiness about Whitman's poem.
Oh, he was a great erotic poet.
Michael Cunningham.
Brilliant at eroticizing not only men and women, but the city itself. He found a crowded street sexy. I mean, who doesn't?
John Adams.
And when you say erotic, it isn't just sexual attraction to another person, but it's a kind of feeling of the whole body, a physical attraction to objects, to colors, to sounds, to smells. That's why Whitman loved New York, because it smelled of people. It was a turn-on for him.
He says at times in his poems that just brushing against others becomes satisfying to him.
All over Whitman's poetry, you have these scenes of crossing paths with a multitude of anonymous others. And that's so distinctive in Whitman. It makes him categorically the city poet. He's the poet of strangers.
He loves strangers, yes.
Whitman is somebody who is trying to catch somebody's eye, you might say.
Philip Lopate.
There's a poem of his that captures this called To a Stranger. Shall I read it?
Please.
Passing stranger, you do not know how longingly I look upon you.
You must be he I was seeking, or she I was seeking. It comes to me as of a dream.
It comes to me as of a dream. I have somewhere surely lived a life of joy with you. All is recalled as we flit by each other, fluid, affectionate, chaste, matured.
You grew up with me, were a boy with me, or a girl with me. I ate with you and slept with you. Your body has become not yours only, nor left my body mine only.
You give me the pleasures of your eyes, face, flesh, as we pass. You take of my beard,
breast, hands in return.
I am not to speak to you. I am to think of you when I sit alone or wake at night alone.
I am to wait. I do not doubt I am to meet you again.
I am to see to it that I do not lose you.
Well, I think it's a very nice poem, but I don't know that I totally agree with it. I think it's a wonderful attitude to have if you feel that you're connected with everyone.
I've definitely had that, yes.
Yes, that totally. That happens all the time, especially on subways. Like when you're sitting facing a person and suddenly there is an eye contact, but you're not really talking, but there is still a connection.
Sometimes you feel a spark. I know that person, and then I know there's no possible way I can know that person.
Now, one of the things that's notable about that poem is there's also a lot of longing and frustration in it. There's always the promise of a connection, but very rarely is there actually the connection. So in a way, New York becomes this city of erotic promise. The streets are filled with sensuality and also a city of loneliness and frustration.
This is the city. And I am one of its citizens. Whatever interests the rest interests me. Politics, churches, newspapers, schools, benevolent societies, improvements, banks, tariffs, steamships, factories, markets, stocks and stores and real estate and personal estate. Do you take it I would astonish? Does the daylight astonish, or the early red start twittering through the woods? Do I astonish more than they?
Once again, writer Philip Lope.
When Whitman encountered Manhattan in the 1840s and 50s, it was beginning to explode, to burst at the seams, and to become an incredibly important city. And one of the main reasons was the port of New York. You have to imagine a waterfront that is completely jammed with masts, you know, one after the other, and every kind of boat imaginable.
Whitman came of age with the city. which was quickly reinventing itself as the commercial capital of North America. According to historian Kenneth Jackson, with the extraordinary growth of the city came a new cultural space for people to reinvent themselves.
It was a big city. There are thousands and thousands of people walking around. So I think you're beginning to experience what in some ways is really the genius of a great city, which is it allows people to be who they want to be and how they want to be and what they can be in a way that's just not possible in a small town in Iowa.
Well, one of the big questions about Walt is, how does a working class guy who has to drop out of school become a poet?
Karen Carpenter is a Whitman scholar and curator of a Whitman exhibit in Lower Manhattan, where Robert Warner runs a 19th century print shop.
So I'm going to set letters into a composing stick.
He dropped out of school at age 10. His had a big family, a lot of sickness. His father was probably an alcoholic. And Whitman, after a couple of other jobs, he settled into the printing business.
At this point, I'm rolling ink out onto a slab of marble.
Now, why this is totally fascinating to me is because he falls in love with language this way. Printing is the only working class profession where literacy is a key ingredient to what you do. And I can't think of another way that a young man at that time could have gotten so much in touch with language and words.
In Whitman's time, New York City was in the middle of a media revolution when newspapers went from being providers of business information to sources of political news, commentary, and lifestyle features. From printer's apprentice, Whitman worked his way up to become a freelance reporter, then editor and columnist.
And he's writing about things as common and ordinary as people catching a ferry. You know, looking out, opening your eyes, and writing about the world around you. Just 30 years before he did that, nobody was doing that. That was not what newspapers did.
That was not what poets did either. Until Whitman, whose poems sometimes read like a sequence in a documentary film.
The peddler sweats with his pack on his back. The purchaser haggles about the odd scent. The camera and plate are prepared. The lady must sit for her daguerreotype. The bride unrumples her white dress. The minute hand of the clock moves slowly. The opium eater reclines with rigid head and just opened lips. The prostitute draggles her shawl. Her bonnet bobs on her tipsy and pimpled neck. The crowd laugh at her blackguard oaths. The men jeer and wink to each other. Miserable. I do not laugh at your oaths, nor jeer you.
In that short passage, we see more types of people, more contemporary reality, than had ever been included in American poetry.
He just was too large to write those little poems to a waterfowl that were being written by his contemporaries. It wasn't that he was rebelling, it's that he completely bypassed all that.
In Whitman's day, the extraordinary diversity of New York City was already evident. By the mid-1800s, 500,000 people crammed together in a city that extended no further north than 14th Street. Immigrants poured in from Europe. Whitman's Fort Greene section of Brooklyn was known as Little Dublin, a shantytown crowded with Irish immigrants and African Americans. Dozens of languages were heard on the street. Even the cityscape itself was heterogeneous. Tall buildings up against small ones, churches next to boarding houses. Philip Lopate thinks Whitman was among the first to get what New York City was all about.
Whitman understood the aesthetic of simultaneity, which was the same aesthetic that in the next century Frank O'Hara would celebrate, the idea that the car is honking, the woman is passing, you see somebody sticking a toothpick in their teeth, and then you notice the top of a building.
Whitman scholar Peter Coviello.
I think of all the great inheritors of Whitman, and there are many, you know, Hart Crane and Wallace Stevens, and really a particular favorite of mine is John Ashbery, who's still alive now. And they're working to make the charged expression that is poetry contain more of language, contain more of the world.
Whitman painted one of the earliest canvases of New York City. Many writers since have stood on his shoulders to observe the urban landscape with open eyes. Henry Miller, James Baldwin, Entezaki Shange, Federico Garcia Lorca, Audre Lorde, to name just a few. Philip Lopate.
He certainly gives permission to any writer, including myself, to go for broke, to keep adding one darn thing after another, to disregard what is poetic and to take everything as poetic. Every scrap of iron, every person you encounter.
Give me faces in streets. Give me these phantoms, incessant and endless, along the trottoirs. Give me interminable eyes. Give me women. Give me comrades and lovers by the thousand. Let me see new ones every day. Let me hold new ones by the hand every day. Give me such shows. Give me the streets. Give me the streets of Manhattan.
Coming up on Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, Whitman's passion for all things cultural, high and low. Stay tuned. You're listening to Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, from WNYC, New York Public Radio. I'm Carl Hancock Rux. If Walt Whitman were alive today, here's how I imagine him. He wouldn't be a stuffy academic poet hiding behind his tenure at some Ivy League university. He'd be hanging out with short story writers at the KGB bar. He would do standing room at the Metropolitan Opera and marvel at hip-hop for its vernacular energy and outlaw posturing. He would go to the movies to catch a German expressionist flick and watch TV, lots of it. He would send letters to the editors at the New York Times and Vibe magazine, fiercely defending free speech or disagreeing with a political essay or CD review. And all of it, one way or another, would work its way into his poetry. At least that's what he did in his own day. Whitman loved everything, from the vulgar showmanship of P.T. Barnum's American Museum, where they displayed items like The Fiji Mermaid, to the plays of Shakespeare. Whitman found his voice in the pop culture of his day.
Our crowd is slowing down. I'm going to bring them in this smelly alley right now. Okay, this is a street called Theater Alley. You can see some of the old vaudeville signs.
Karen Carpenter, leading a walking tour of Lower Manhattan.
Back at that time, the Park Theater and the other big theaters had, just like we do, an orchestra and then different levels of balconies. And on the very top, you sat if you were a reviewer or, can anyone guess the other profession that was up there? Yes, the prostitutes were up there. And they were up there for a reason, because the rich men in the orchestra pit could look up and choose which woman they would want to be with.
Whitman was crazy about the theater. He said that he went to plays so that his whole emotional nature be powerfully stirred. He never had much money, so he often sat amongst the prostitutes in the balcony, where he reveled in the raucous atmosphere and melodramatic performances. One of his favorite actors was Junius Brutus Booth, who biographer David Reynolds says defied theatrical tradition by creating his own emotionally extravagant style.
And sometimes Junius Brutus Booth would literally get in a sword fight on stage and chase the person outside and continue it right outside. Whitman said that Booth was an absolute revelation to me in the way that he just delivered his commanding performances.
Poetry is my greatest stage, Whitman once wrote. Poetry was also his greatest pulpit. Political and religious oratory were popular entertainments in Whitman's day, and this passage sounds like the soliloquy of a highly unorthodox preacher.
I hear and behold God in every object, yet I understand God not in the least. Nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24 and each moment then. In the faces of men and women, I see God. And in my own face, in the glass, I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed by God's name. And I leave them where they are, for I know that others will punctually come forever and ever.
Slumber, my darling, thy mother is near, guarding thy dreams from all terror and fear.
When it came to music, Whitman favored American songwriters like Stephen Foster. He preferred the simplicity of what he called heart singing over European art singing. But he changed his tune in the 1840s after one type of exotic European music took New York by storm. Without it, Whitman said he could not have written Leaves of Grass. Opera, Whitman found the same fire, energy, and emotional abandon that he loved in Junius Brutus Booth's acting. In fact, the only performer who meant more to him was Marietta Alboni, an Italian contralto with a passionate following among workers as well as opera connoisseurs.
She gave one concert where literally she couldn't be heard after the first words came out of her mouth because she was just so glorious. There was just a storm of this is just incredible. And she started weeping, and Whitman was at that performance.
The sound of the human voice literally sent him over the edge. He compares it to having an orgasm.
I hear the trained soprano. She convulses me like the climax of my love grip. I am exposed, cut by bitter and poisoned hail, steeped amid honeyed morphine, my windpipe squeezed in the fakes of death, let up again to feel the puzzle of puzzles and that we call being.
Being with a capital B. And the fact that Marietta Alboni or someone like that is convulsing him like the climax of his love grip, I don't even want to go into that. But obviously there's a physical side of an emotional experience.
He would sit upstairs in the 25-cent seats and just let that sound wash over him. And it just turned him on. I mean, this is a gay man at the opera. Come on.
According to musicologist Denise Gallo, Whitman heard echoes of New York City in Italian opera.
He actually equates the young workers in Manhattan singing out their calls, let's say, the same way an Italian opera singer would perform. So it's this liberated, free-flowing language that he hears in the streets around him.
Whitman said his own language was deeply affected by a style of opera called bel canto.
Literally, the definition would be beautiful singing, but it goes much deeper than that.
Bel canto is not a simple concept, but opera teacher and stage director Ira Siff explains.
A bel canto melody really grabs you, tugs at your heartstrings, and the combination of the sound of the human voice and the soul that comes through the human voice with beautiful Italian words laid onto a stunningly haunting melody can easily bring one to tears and has a profound effect.
The bel canto opera features a very long line of vocal music. And then, of course, you look at Whitman's poetry. And what does it have? Very long lines, unlike any other poetry of its time.
Composer Ned Roram.
Whitman belongs to me, and I sort of therefore resent all these other settings of Whitman, even the ones that came before me.
Charles Ives, Ralph Vaughan Williams, Kurt Weill, Jennifer Higdon, Fred Hirsch, and many others have set Whitman poems. But perhaps no one has felt the pull more powerfully than Ned Roram.
Whitman is not evasive. Therefore, what he says is clear and can be imparted through the sung voice. Not all poets wear their heart on their sleeve. But he does, but without embarrassment to us.
It's astonishing when somebody has something really, really, really serious and deep to say. They don't say it in florid language. They say it in absolutely direct English.
Composer John Adams thinks of Whitman as an artistic model, despite the poet's shortcomings.
We find vulgarity. We find embarrassing stuff in Whitman that's just so bad, you know, sentimental and, you know, pulling the heartstrings. And then we find just the greatest moments in American literature. It's the real thing. And to me, that's a great inspiration.
You're listening to Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, from WNYC, New York Public Radio. I'm Carl Hancock Rux. Okay, so theater, oratory, opera, journalism, and New York City itself help explain where Walt Whitman got his language and style. But how do you account for his outsized, outrageous personality? How do you account for poetry like this?
Walt Whitman, an American, one of the roughs, cosmos, disorderly, fleshy, and sensual, eating, drinking, and breeding. No sentimentalist, no stander above men and women or apart from them. No more modest than immodest. Unscrew the locks from the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams.
When Whitman presents himself as I am Walt Whitman, one of the roughs, turbulent, fleshy, eating, drinking, sensual, and all this, he's actually none of those things. He was a somewhat dapper journalist, so he's really, you know, lying when he says one of the roughs. And it's very much of a persona, but it's a persona largely from the city streets.
Was his identity a lie or self-reinvention? Was he assuming a new identity for himself, or was he modeling a style for future Americans?
I celebrate myself, and what I assume, you shall assume.
Publisher Max Rudin.
He's not only talking about assumptions in the mental sense, he's talking about literally taking on a certain kind of role, assuming a role, but assuming it so that you live it and believe it.
Original gangster.
Just as rock and roll and hip-hop culture created a bad boy persona culled from Hollywood mobsters and the legend of anti-heroes, Whitman based part of his character on the roughs of his day, working-class street toughs, the original American gangster. Karen Carpenter.
Yeah, well, he loved these. I mean, part of it is a sexual attraction, too, because these guys were cute. I mean, they represented masculine, hardy, brawny type of character that he would have loved.
He is going to put himself in the body of a street tough and look at the world that way. Many people, of course, found this absurd. One of his friends said, Whitman is a poseur of truly colossal proportions. But he's a certain kind of poseur. He's a poseur who's been playing the part so long, he doesn't know he's playing it anymore.
Novelist Michael Cunningham.
Whitman was, as far as I know, one of the first people who essentially invented a persona and portrayed the person he'd invented until he actually became that person.
Whitman may have been one of the first artists, but certainly not the last, to reinvent himself on the streets of New York City. Choreographer Bill T. Jones.
If you think of like an Andy Warhol, Andrew Warhola from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, comes to New York and here's a place where he can release the inner freak within him. And what's more, he even found an audience for it and he became extremely famous. And all the little lemmings out there, like myself and others, took note. Ah, look. Look how weird he was. It's all right.
Like Warhol and many other self-invented personalities, Bob Dylan, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Madonna, P. Diddy, Ralph Lipschitz, a.k.a. Ralph Lauren, Whitman had a nose for publicity. After publishing Leaves of Grass at his own expense, he became his own ethically challenged publicist, David Reynolds.
He wrote three very friendly, favorable reviews of his own work, and he published them anonymously, these long, glowing reviews, trying to promote his cause.
In spite of his efforts, few copies sold. He did, however, receive glowing praise in a letter from Ralph Waldo Emerson, the most famous intellectual of the day, Whitman scholar David Blake.
Well, Whitman took that letter and had it printed in various newspapers, all without Emerson's permission. The next year, in 1856, when he published another edition of Leaves of Grass, he had Emerson's comment, I greet you at the beginning of a great career, engraved in gold lettering on the spine of each one of these volumes. It was, in one sense, the first blurb that we're so used to with books today.
Before publishing Leaves of Grass, Whitman shortened his first name from Walter to Walt, an early gesture in a lifelong effort to shape his public image. In old age, pictures show him as the good gray poet, a slightly bohemian Santa Claus with a pillowy face and a hint of romanticism in his eyes. Safe. But in the 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass, Karen Carpenter says he projected a much hipper image.
That frontispiece picture of him, without the usual poet's tie, without the usual posturing and faraway look, instead that aggressive one-on-one stance and the Gap ad clothing, the chinos, the hands in the pockets, the cocked hat. It's so contemporary and modern feeling.
There was a kind of genius in him.
Bill T. Jones.
He understood style and he understood a thing that, which we call the media now. That's kind of mysterious and kind of wonderful.
Coming up on Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, Race, Sex, and Radical Sympathy. Stay with us. This is Carl Hancock Rux, and you're listening to Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, from WNYC, New York Public Radio.
Through me, many long dumb voices, voices of the interminable generations of slaves, voices of prostitutes and of deformed persons, voices of the diseased and despairing, and of thieves and dwarfs, voices of cycles of preparation and accretion, and of the threads that connect the stars, and of wombs, and of the father stuff, and of the rights of them the others are down upon, of the trivial and flat and foolish and despised, of fog in the air and beetles rolling balls of dung.
Walt Whitman was a radical poet, maybe America's most radical poet. He changed the way poets write and what they write about, so that free verse and poems about anything and everything seem normal today. But he broke more than literary boundaries. As novelist Michael Cunningham explains, the most radical aspect of Whitman, even for us today, may be the extraordinary range and degree of Whitman's human sympathies.
He simply believed that there was no one alive who was ordinary or uninteresting. There were only inadequate ways of looking at the people in front of you.
Everybody works their way into Leaves of Grass.
Karen Carpenter.
I mean, that's the truly magical thing, because a lot of writers, a lot of cultural figures would stay on one side of town. Whitman was the type of guy who went to both sides.
He keeps coming back to the most marginalized and most despised people in society.
Poet Martín Espada.
He refers to prisoners, he refers to prostitutes, he refers to the poor, the working class, he refers to slaves.
The runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. I heard his motions crackling the twigs of the woodpile. Through the half-swung door of the kitchen I saw him, limpsy and weak, and went where he sat on a log, and led him in, and assured him, and brought water, and filled a tub for his sweated body and bruised feet, and gave him a room that entered from my own, and gave him some coarse, clean clothes, and remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next to me at table. My firelock leaned in the corner.
It was Whitman in the introduction to the 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass who said the duty of the poet was to cheer up slaves and horrify despots. How many of us are doing that?
And how many of us are actually stepping into the skins of slaves? Whitman tries to do just that. In this famous passage from Song of Myself.
I am the hounded slave. I wince at the bite of the dogs. Hell and despair are upon me. Crack and again crack the marksmen. I clutch the rails of the fence. My gore dribs thinned with the ooze of my skin. I fall on the weeds and stones. The riders spur their unwilling horses and haul close. They taunt my dizzy ears. They beat me violently over the head with their whipstocks.
People might consider it arrogant, you know, because he puts himself in the voice of slaves.
Ishul Yee Park is the poet laureate of Queens.
There could be a way that you could look at it and be like, oh, how dare he? But there's another way that you could look at it and be like, wow, that's very brave of him to even try to attempt to understand the feelings and the experiences of this person who is so different from him.
Did he really feel what slavery was?
Bill T. Jones.
I don't think Walt Whitman really had to deal with that many true other identities. Did he know any Native Americans? Did he know Asians? Did he really have to look at it? No, he didn't. He was still in some sort of theoretical phase. We are in the trenches now.
One little phrase that kind of jarred me when I read his Song of Myself was, the barbarians of Africa and Asia are not nothing. That were just a little bit stereotypical, but, you know, that's to be expected. I mean, we have to be understanding when we're reading works that were written 100 years ago, and they're not subject to, like, the race politics of today.
Whitman vehemently opposed slavery, but he was no abolitionist. Like a lot of white men of his day, his racial politics were complicated and contradictory. David Reynolds.
The abolitionists, like William Lloyd Garrison, wanted to divide America between the North and the South because they figured the South is not going to give up slavery, and the abolitionists didn't want to go to war over it. And they said, let's just divide this nation. And Whitman loved the American Union.
Whitman scholar Peter Coviello.
Like other Unionists, Whitman was perfectly willing to see the Union preserved, even if that was at the expense of a just and lasting freedom for African America.
Whitman feared when reform became too fanatical, it could become divisive itself. And that's why he said, be radical, be radical, be radical, be not too damned radical.
Karen Carpenter.
Walt's breaking boundaries every which way, right? So he's embracing early women's rights activism. And I love this quote from A Woman Waits for Me. At a time when women are corseted, right, he writes, they are not one jot less.
They are not one jot less than I am. They are tanned in the face by shining suns and blowing winds. Their flesh has the old divine suppleness and strength. They know how to swim, row, ride, wrestle, shoot, run, strike, retreat, advance, resist, defend themselves. They are ultimate in their own right.
Whitman paid close attention to women, to the body, and to sex itself. Without using obscene language, it's hard to imagine poetry more sexually explicit than this.
Hair, bosom, hips, bend of legs, negligent, falling hands, all diffused. Mine too diffused. Ebb stung by the flow, and flow stung by the ebb. Love, flesh swelling and deliciously aching. Limitless, limpid jets of love, hot and enormous, quivering jelly of love, white blow and delirious juice. Bridegroom night of love, working surely and softly into the prostrate dawn, undulating into the willing and yielding day, lost in the cleave of the clasping and sweet-fleshed day.
Lost in the cleave of the clasping and sweet flesh day. Okay, I can barely read that without cracking up. I mean, even after having read it 1,000 times, it just is so frank and so gorgeously wrapped up in the sensual moment. Part of Walt was always smiling, and he knew he wanted to be outrageous.
As far as the overcoming of shame, there is no other poet. He's that poet.
Peter Coviello.
Whitman's poetry is all about a refusal of and rebuking of shame in any form. Social shame, sexual shame, bodily shame. That's part of what coming to speak in his own voice really means for him. It means for him, I have found a way to speak above and through what would shame me otherwise into silence.
Remember, he was talking about the Victorian days.
Greg Trupiano.
So certain things that we might consider tame were scandalous.
David Blake.
When Harvard purchased a copy of Leaves of Grass, they kept that book in the biology building under lock and key. So it wasn't even part of the library because it was considered to be more akin to anatomy than to poetry.
Even Ralph Waldo Emerson worried about the carnality in Leaves of Grass.
Emerson begs Whitman, don't publish this. Take out the sex. And Whitman, as they walk through Boston Common, says, sex is the kernel of my poetry. And Emerson said, it's too distracting. People will only focus on this and not on the other great poetry you're writing. And at the end of the 2 hours, Whitman says, I can't do it. And Emerson acquiesced, and they went off and had dinner together.
It's the type of thing that, like Ginsberg, Henry Miller, radicals of the 20th century thought was so cool that he actually stood up for the radical content.
I'm really proud that he did that. I need stories like that.
Bill T. Jones.
Because I think we are now faced with, quote, professional art world, and there's purely market-driven censorships. This artist does nudity. Oh, some people won't book you. To be subversive now is, I think it takes a lot of finesse. It takes a lot of study.
Today, what looks most subversive about Whitman is his homoerotic verse.
Earth, my likeness. Though you look so impassive, ample and spheric there, I now suspect that is not all. I now suspect there is something fierce in you, eligible to burst forth. For an athlete is enamored of me, and I of him. But toward him there is something fierce and terrible in me, eligible to burst forth. I dare not tell it in words, not even in these songs.
Whitman's sexuality is still fodder for debate. Critic Harold Bloom has long argued that Whitman never had sex with women or with men.
One wishes that Whitman had achieved homoerotic fulfillment, since clearly he yearns for it so greatly, but the evidence shows that he speaks proudly for Onan.
I don't buy that. Whitman loved men.
Greg Trupiano.
I don't care if you call it gay. I would call it queer. That's how I identify myself. I think he was a queer role model.
Whitman, for all his big, fabulous life and all his friends, was essentially a lonely man.
Michael Cunningham.
He said toward the end of his life that he was sorry he never found that great companion, though he certainly had a boyfriend or two. But he clearly spent his life looking for a kind of connection and intimacy with another person that he felt he never found.
And Whitman felt it very keenly and seems always to have longed to make connections with others.
Joanne Krieg.
It appears in many, many of the poems, but I think especially one finds it in a short poem that was written in 1868, A Noiseless Patient Spider.
A noiseless, patient spider. I marked where on a little promontory it stood isolated. Marked how to explore the vacant, vast surrounding. It launched forth filament, filament, filament out of itself, ever unreeling them, ever tirelessly speeding them. And you, O my soul, where you stand, surrounded, detached, in measureless oceans of space, ceaselessly musing, venturing, throwing, seeking the spheres to connect them, till the bridge you will need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread you fling catch somewhere, O my soul.
That longing to have the connection catch somewhere. And of course, the web of the spider becomes the poem itself, and these threads that come out of the poet's own being are the poems that he tosses out, seeking to connect somewhere.
You're listening to Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, from WNYC, New York Public Radio. I'm Carl Hancock Rux. Did you too, O friend, suppose democracy was only for elections, for politics, and for a party name, Whitman once wrote? For Whitman, true democracy meant a spirit of love and inclusion that embraced everyone in American society, from sex workers to new immigrants to African Americans to the President of the United States. He was even an advocate for rights of the mentally ill and for asylum reform. No one was ranked higher or lower than anyone else.
And that's why in his poetry he says, I am the poet of slaves and of the masters of slaves.
Whitman hoped that as the poet of democracy, he would help transform America into a society of loving comradeship. David Reynolds.
By the early 1850s, when it looked like the nation would fall apart over the slavery issue, he kind of rushed in to fill that vacuum and had a very utopian view of that first edition of Leaves of Grass. He really felt that somehow his poetry could become a seed of togetherness and unity in his country. He really believed that the poet could be a healer.
But Leaves of Grass didn't immediately reach people the way Whitman wanted it to. 5 years after it was first published, the Civil War broke out. Whitman's lofty hopes for healing the country were dashed.
On the one hand, he recognizes that his former dream for the nation is just shattered. It's not going to work. On the other hand, he doesn't quite surrender it.
Instead, says Peter Coviello, he set out to accomplish in person what his book had failed to do. During the Civil War, Whitman visited wounded soldiers and hospitals in and around Washington, D.C. Going from bed to bed, he brought the young men gifts, wrote letters home for them, sat with them as they died. Counting all, he wrote, I went to between 80,000 and 100,000 soldiers.
Sounds like a boast about circulation, like of a sort that an author would make. And there's something really just inexpressibly moving about Whitman's transfer of a literary and aesthetic ideal of nationalism into the stuff of his daily life. Unable to send his book out to do his work, he is going to go bed by bed offering his love to these virtual strangers, one after the other, one after the other, one after the other.
Straight and swift to my wounded I go, where they lie on the ground after the battle brought me.
Whitman set the bar for success so high that of course he failed. No book could have prevented the Civil War, and the idea of poet or artist as healer is a controversial one.
I don't think Dr. Whitman's gonna, like, come to your rescue. You come to your own rescue.
Performance artist Laurie Anderson.
For me, it can't be first on my list. It can't heal people, no. That may be secretly my goal, but I would never admit it. Because it's so presumptuous, you know. Seems insane to me.
Michael Cunningham.
Whitman was not the first or the last poet to overestimate the reach and power of poetry. Poetry is a tremendously powerful and durable entity, and some of the poems we love today will be around long after every politician who's making our lives miserable is gone and forgotten.
Those of us in the Church of Art are there because there's something wounded.
Bill T. Jones.
And something that says that unless you move, you will die. Now, this whole thing, unless you move, the world will collapse, that's another thing. But unless you move, I think that happened to him. And I think it's tied up with his sexuality. I think it's tied up with his spirituality. And the greatest gift of all, he was born into an era that needed a Walt Whitman.
Do we need Walt Whitman today? To answer that question, David Reynolds says, try reading Whitman outside on a warm, sunny day.
To me, it's an incredibly refreshing experience. To me, it's a healing experience, and I think that if many people did this, they would get not only a certain kind of inner healing, but also a kind of social healing, saying, hey, why don't I like that person over there because he happens to be of a different color than I or a different religion than I? Look at this vision of togetherness that we have here.
By the time he died in 1892, Whitman had succeeded in making himself a celebrity and earned the grudging respect of the literati. He was known for his Civil War poems and his great elegy of Abraham Lincoln, When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. He also wrote provocative social criticism, dissecting the ills of the Gilded Age. But he once said, "The proof of a poet is that his country absorbs him as affectionately as he has absorbed it."
Late in life, he said, you know, he told a friend, the people. I always wanted to reach the people. Even today, unfortunately, maybe he hasn't reached the people, the average people, as much as he would have liked to.
I still feel that we as a society are not ready for Whitman.
Martin Espada.
We're not ready for his message of radical egalitarianism. We're not ready for his message of universal compassion. Whitman, as an abstract notion, is easy to embrace. Whitman, the poet of democracy with a small d, is much more difficult to embrace.
But Espada says that Whitman's legacy is undeniable.
Whitman's influence is so pervasive that sometimes he has an effect on poets who don't even realize he's there. When I published my first book, I was 24 years old. I had no idea that Whitman had the effect on me that he did.
Whitman's influence on poets around the world has been profound. Pablo Neruda in Chile, Jorge Luis Borges in Argentina, D.H. Lawrence in England, Fernando Pessoa in Portugal, not to mention American poets, Langston Hughes, Hart Crane, Lucille Clifton, and Sexton.
I could go on and on about how feminist poets like Erica Jong and Adrienne Rich totally embrace him, how you have musicians and artists, artists like Jackson Pollock, musicians like Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen.
Leaves of Grass has basically created a voice for American poetry.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked.
I think Ginsberg was probably the last true Whitman poet. But all of us are the children or grandchildren of Whitman.
What poetry can contain after Whitman touches it suddenly expands unprecedentedly. And people are still trying to catch up with that.
The essence of his art is simplicity and directness and sincerity. You find it in the music of the greatest of jazz players like Ellington or Miles Davis. It represents the better part of our national personality.
He includes everybody. He includes lepers, he includes prostitutes, and he will love everyone and include them in his work.
He is the poet of democracy. He is the poet of the experiment of the United States.
Whitman equals America, because he is American. He wrote about America, and he was proud to be American, but not in a flag-waving way, but in a way that speaks to my heart.
And it goes beyond poetry. Whitman has found his way into the language itself, has found his way into the air we breathe.
Listener up there, hear you. What have you to confide to me? Look in my face while I snuff the sidle of evening. Talk honestly, for no one else hears you, and I stay only a minute longer. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then. I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes.
Mr. Whitman, here we are 150 years later, and we're still wondering, was Leaves of Grass just a book of poems? Yes, and absolutely not. Walt Whitman's Song of Myself was produced by Curtis Fox. Julie Subrin was the associate producer, and the assistant producer was James Murdoch. Elena Park was editor and executive producer. The readers were Mike Daisy, Paul Giamatti, Bob Holman, Bill T. Jones, Christina Kirk, Jonathan Myers, Mary Myers, Michael Stuhlbarg, Joao de Souza, and Jeffrey Wright. Special thanks to Isaiah Scheffer and Symphony Space, Lanny Myers, Karen Coonrod, Richard Tayson, and Crystalline Wright. Production support from Dean Capello, George Preston, Chris Bannon, and Howard Carolyn. For more on Whitman and the music and poetry you heard on this program, visit our website at wnyc.org. Walt Whitman's Song of Myself was made possible in part by a grant from Joshua Feigenbaum and by the listeners of WNYC New York Public Radio. I'm Carl Hancock Russ.
Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you.